This is not just coal. One thing that's important to understand is that this is a multi-commodity facility. So it is designed for dry bulk cargoes. And really what we're trying to do is target the northern tier of the United States. So everywhere from the Midwest through to Montana to Idaho and eastern Washington, trying to provide an access for those bulk commodities, be it grain, be it coal. Coal will be a large element of the facility.
How large?
To start with, it's a 54-million-ton facility. Coal would be, right now, 48 million tons of that. So a very large facility. One thing you have to understand, though, is 3-4 years ago, coal was not on the radar as a commodity. So For exports, yeah. So 5 or 6 years from now, it may not be again. So as a developer, this is over $700 million my company is going to invest in this infrastructure. So when you look at that, what you need to do from a developer standpoint, and this is a 50-year asset, it's almost like your 401k, right? You want to have diversification in that to weather all kinds of storms. What we have to do is look at this and say, we need to be able to handle a number of different types of commodities, because one commodity is going to be in demand over a certain period of time within that 50 years, and it's going to be cyclical in nature, and some of them are not. So we have to be agile and flexible to handle a number of different types of commodities.
Would you then build this terminal if you didn't have coal contracts?
Well, if we did, it would be at a smaller scale probably, right? So
Quite a bit. The
whole scale is going to depend on what demand is. Well, we don't even know that it'll get built to 54 million tons to begin with, right? So it can be phased in.
Why is this a good site?
The site is very unique in the United States. We have
It's deep, isn't it? It's
deep. Yeah, it's got four key attributes actually that kind of make this a special property, special asset. One is that since the 1980s, it's zoned as heavy industry. Our neighbors are a Cherry Point. At Cherry Point, our neighbors are a BP refinery, a ConocoPhillips refinery, and an Alcoa aluminum smelter. So this was an area in the 1980s that Whatcom County, the local county where we're building the project, Whatcom County Council had decided this is where we want to have our industrial-based union family wage jobs. We don't want it to be in the city. We want it to be out in this more rural-type area. And because we do have the water there, we want these to be water-dependent industries.
Why don't you want it in the city?
They didn't want industry in with the city. They wanted to separate it out in a separate area, right?
Okay.
So getting back to the attributes, so one is that it's zoned heavy industry. Two is that rail already has access out there, which is key for any kind of bulk commodity to be transited to the facility. Three is that in our facility there, we have 1,500 acres, a site for 1,500 acres. We're only going to use about 25% of that for the actual project itself. The rest of it's going to be left in a natural state as a buffer to protect the rest of the environment from anything that, you know, from our operations. So we're insulating ourselves and the environment. We're actually, if you look at where we're going to have our terminal, it's going to be about a half a mile away from the water, and everything's going to be conveyed out to the vessels themselves. So the actual operations will be about a half a mile away from the water
conveyed
itself.
Conveyed how?
On conveyors. And then finally, and most important, the element that you raised is that we have natural deep water. We have 80 feet of water. So what's unique about this is there's really no place else on the West Coast that has that depth of water. We don't have to do any dredging, so there's no impact from an environmental standpoint relative to dredging. And the real benefit and what this means beneficially to all the dry bulk producers in the Midwest out to the West Coast of the United States is that we can handle the largest dry bulk ships in the world. So these are what they call Cape-sized ships. They're ships that are too big to go through the Panama Canal that they have to go down around the Cape. That's why they're called Cape-sized ships.
And are these ships coming into that area at this point or not?
They're coming into Canadian ports right now. They're not coming into Washington ports for
because
these kind of bulk ships.
Because they can't handle them
yet. Yeah, the other ports, you know, like Port of Seattle only has like 55 feet of water.
Right.
So the real benefit here.
So this would be first.
Yeah, this would be the first for Washington and Pacific Northwest ports, right? So the real benefit here, what that means is the other ports can handle what are called Panamax ships, which mean that they can go through the Panama Canal, the size that can go through the canal. They handle 80,000 deadweight tons on the ship. Our larger ships can handle 250,000 deadweight tons. So what happens there is just on an economies of scale basis, when you're shipping on a larger vessel like that, you can save up to 50% in transportation costs for U.S. commodities going to Asia, which allows the U.S. commodities to be competitive in the international arena on a more frequent basis, right? So as commodity prices goes up and down, this kind of allows you to have a lower, least common cost denominator and be competitive on a more broad basis.
Are the rail facilities that currently serve that port adequate for this new terminal?
One of the things that they're doing, Burlington Northern Santa Fe is the railroad that will support the facility. And they have an existing track that goes in there. Within their own right of their current right-of-way now, what they want to do is put in a second track. So it's all within the same right-of-way, but to handle the additional volume, they want to put in a second track.
I read somewhere that there would be an increase of about 18 trains a day.
At full capacity, we would have 18 trains a day. And what that means is 9 loaded trains coming in a day and 9 empties going back out a day.
Mm-hmm. As you know, Mr. Waters, there's a lot of objection to this
mm-hmm.
terminal.
I've heard.
And you're about to hear them again as we address them. And one of the objections is coal dust. A lot of debate about whether coal dust is harmful to the health and also whether it escapes when it's hauled enough to affect human health.
Part of what we're doing right now in our process is we're just now getting into the EIS process. And that is likely one of the elements that the agencies, the federal agencies, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Washington State Department of Ecology are going to require to be studied, right? So, like you said, there's debate now. We're anticipating and embracing the concept of the science actually coming out and showing.
You think it'll be in your favor?
Yeah, we've done our own preliminary studies. We wouldn't be investing this kind of money if we hadn't done some of our own kind of peripheral, you know, secondary research type studies. What we found is a number of things. I think one thing that's really important to understand is we've gone down to Campbell County, Wyoming. And in Campbell County, Wyoming, they have 25% of the Powder River Basin mines. They have 5 times as many trains as we would have going through to our facility. And again, remember, this is close to the mines, right, where if there were going to be any kind of dust coming off trains, you would have a higher incidence of dust near the mines than you would 12,000 miles away. Right near our facilities. Campbell County, Wyoming's Chamber of Commerce had put out, the medical officer had put out information that said for the respiratory illnesses most commonly linked with coal dust, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, and childhood bronchitis, all 3 of those are at or below the U.S. norm. Right? So when you're looking at that kind of information where you have a much higher incidence of coal train traffic versus what we would have there, and all those the incidence of those illnesses are at or below the U.S. norms, you would conclude that there's not much of a case there.
How many people live in Campbell County, Wyoming?
Well, enough. I don't know what the population
compared
is.
To Bellingham, it's probably yeah. quite a bit less.
Probably. The other thing you need to understand is before this project, now, coal trains have been going through the state of Washington for decades, right? And they're going up through the same transportation corridor going up to ports in Canada right now, right? And that will continue as they expand. Those trains are going to come through as the Canadian ports expand their capacity, whether our project happens or not, right? So those trains will still come through. Now, one thing that's important to understand is while that had been happening before our project was announced, we checked with the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency and the Northwest Clean Air Agency, and there had never been any complaints or concerns about coal dust. Right? In all the years it had been transferred through there.
And the other objection to the increase in rail traffic, especially through an area as populated as that part of the coast, Bellingham and so mm-hmm. on, is just the increased train traffic will cause traffic delays and that there would be emergency vehicle problems getting through because of the increased train traffic and so on.
As I said before, what they're doing in Canada right now is they are doing expansions of the facilities. They're expanding West Shore terminal.
But we
now.
Have no say over what Canada does, obviously.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. And or how they handle the product once it gets there.
Right.
But the point is they're expanding West Shore, they're expanding Neptune, they're expanding Fraser, Surrey, and they're expanding Rupert, 4 different terminals, right, where the capacity could be in excess of 60 million tons. What that says is if there's a market for this product in Asia, it's going to find its way to the market. Right. So the trains will continue to go on this same route to Canada, whether or not we build this particular facility. Right. The question is, who's going to get the jobs and the tax benefits? Is it going to be kept in the United States, in Washington State? Is it going to go to Canada? The other thing that's important to answer your question is I've spent a lot of time talking with, you talked about emergency vehicles. I've spent a lot of time talking to police and fire people throughout. There's a chief of police in Spokane. Spokane's one of the main areas in which these trains would come through. I've talked in Ferndale. I've talked in Marysville to a number of these different people. And they all, to a person, they come through and say, what you have to understand is we locate our response housing, like fire houses and those, fire truck houses and those kinds of things. They locate those on different sides of the tracks. They do it on different sides of the highways and on the freeways so that they can mitigate these kinds of exposures. They tell me that they never send response from just one location. They always send responses from multiple locations. And they tell me that trains are not the biggest impact. The biggest impacts they have in cities like this where there's a lot of car traffic is drive time.
But that's not the same as no impact, and that would be the point.
No, yeah. Right.
And then the third, and this is probably the biggest objection, and this is one that you will have heard before too, and that is that we shouldn't be promoting development of coal anywhere anymore because of the impact on the climate. That even though we're selling coal to Asia, what burns in Asia affects us all eventually.
And here's what I struggle with on that question and that line of questioning. First of all, let's talk about there's no net increase of greenhouse gases relative to this project or this coal coming from here over to Asia. Okay. In Asia right now, they burn about 5 billion tons a year of coal. We're talking 48 million tons. So that is less than 1% of the total amount. Last year,
let's just take those arguments one at a time. That's like saying no one should recycle because one person recycling won't make a dent.
Well, okay, then let me try a different tack. Okay. What percentage of electricity in Montana is generated by coal?
The vast majority.
Probably 60-plus percent, right?
Yep.
Do the people here want to stop and use 60% less electricity?
The people here have used less electricity, though, and become more energy efficient, and it's a process, as you know, over time.
That's not what I asked. What I asked is, do they want to stop using it altogether?
Of course not.
No, no. So let me ask you another question. So the World Health Organization, right, has estimated that 2 million people a year die prematurely right now because they don't have access to electricity.
But we're not debating whether electricity is good or bad, Mr. Waters. We're debating what should be the source of that electricity, whether it should be coal or some other energy product. Right now it's coal, and it has to be because we don't have the alternatives.
There's for those 25% of the world's population that doesn't have access to electricity right now, those that are impoverished people, there is no other alternative. The lowest cost and means of getting those people power is through coal. Like I said, right now there's 2 million people a year.
But should we be transitioning away from that, do you think?
You know, I don't know the answer. It's a complex situation, isn't it? I mean, there's very few things in our society today that are black and white.
I agree.
You know, it's very complex. So I'm wondering, do people that have it judge and say those that don't have it shouldn't have it? They should continue to burn wood and dung and crop cuttings in their homes to cook and heat rather than have the access to electricity? I don't know.
The point is not whether people need electricity or want electricity or that the have should have it and the have-nots should not, Mr. Waters. The point is, what should be the source of that electricity, and how do you weigh one source versus another in terms of the overall cost-benefit?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is they're going to burn what they're going to burn in Asia, right? Now, you have the opportunity to give them a better product. Coal from Montana is lower in ash content and lower in sulfur.
It's cleaner than what they're
burning. It is cleaner than what they're burning now.
It's so not clean. There's actually, it's not clean.
No.
Cleaner.
That's what I said. I said cleaner. Yeah.
What is your personal opinion of coal's relationship to the change in climate? What's your personal view of that?
You know, I really, on a personal basis, I really haven't gone through and done all the homework. I know there's a lot of information on both sides of it, and I haven't really delved into the details of it on both sides enough to understand and form a articulate opinion on that, an educated opinion on that. There's so much information out there from both sides that I'm having difficulty understanding which is right and which isn't right. Asia's going to burn what they're going to burn in terms of coal, right? Can we give them a cleaner product to do and do it on a better basis? There's benefit to that.
Well, Mr. Waters, I appreciate very much your time. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.